connect local teachers with their students during this time of sheltering in place, we bring you this program of stories, music, and poems.
Hello there. How are you? It's so good to see you. Let's sing and be happy, 'cause we're all back together again. Well, not really, just in a different kind of way. Hello, Ketchikan. This is Miss Jillian, music teacher at Houtling Elementary. Go Dolphins! Previous music teacher at Fawn Mountain, and many of you know me from other places. Art school, productions, so on and so on. I'm just here to tell everybody that I miss you so very much, and I hope that you are still keeping music alive in your homes, whether it's listening to your favorite songs, talking about your favorite bands, or playing any instruments that you might have available to you. I am looking forward to posting some videos online to help keep the music alive and going as we go through this together. I'd love to play a very quick game that many of my students and community members know that I love to play, and that is Secret Simon. You don't need anything to play this. All you need is your hands to clap. I'm going to clap a super top secret, not so secret rhythm, and repeat after me. It goes like this. Okay, that is our super secret, not so secret rhythm. I'm going to clap some other rhythms that you repeat after me. But if I clap that rhythm, the super secret, not so secret rhythm, don't do it. I repeat, don't do it. Think about what it sounded like and what it felt like, what it looked like. And just because I'm feeling extra generous, I'm going to give you that super secret, not so secret rhythm one more time. It goes like this. You are allowed to repeat it this time, and this time only. It goes like... Okay, here we go. If I do that again, don't do it. Maybe I got you, maybe I didn't. All of the younger students out there know I love to trick kids. And this time you're off the hook, because I don't know whether you got it or you didn't. But I am so looking forward to sending out some more love and some more music and jams for everybody. And rock on!
This book today is The Grumpy Morning, and it looks like it's about some animals. On the cover I see a horse and a cow, a goose and a duck and a sheep and a rabbit and a chicken and a pig, and they don't look happy. When I open the book I see it's written by Pamela Duncan Edwards, and the illustrator is Darcia LaBrosse. And there is a grumpy-looking owl with its wings crossed, like its arms are crossed. I heard a cow begin to moo. I need to be milked, I really do. She mooed at the dog, who began to bark. It's time for breakfast, it's no longer dark. So I'm already telling that this is a rhyming story. Bark and dark. See if you can hear the rhyme here. I heard a rabbit begin to thump. I want my pellets. I'll never grow plump. He thumped at the horse, who began to neigh. I'm hungry for hay. I heard a duck begin to quack. What's going on? I must have my snack. She quacked at the cat, who began to meow. I'd like a cuddle. I'd like it now. The cat is sitting in the hay looking sad, and behind the cat is a line of animals, a cow and a rabbit, a horse, a goat, a dog, a pig, and there's a duck in a pond. I heard a hen begin to cluck. My grain is late. That's just my luck. They're passing a scarecrow and going to the house. I saw a moth land on the nose of a sleepy farmer, still in a doze. She opened an eye and said with a cry, "Is that the time? Oh my, good morning, cow. Good morning, dog. Good morning, goat. Good morning, hog. Good morning, rabbit. Good morning, horse, and duck, and cat, and owl, of course. Such a happy morning, isn't it, hen?" Then she fed them and milked them and loved us all 10. And the owl says, "May I sleep now?" And the farmer has her rubber boots on, and she's sitting on a bucket in the barn with hay all around. And the animals look much more happy since they've been fed and cuddled. I hope you're fed and cuddled. Maybe you could write a story yourself about some animals that you know. Or think about some other stories that you know with animals in them. Next time.
Hello, Ketchikan. This is Miss Penny from Houtling Elementary, and I just wanted to say hi to everyone. I miss seeing your faces. I can't wait till we're back together again. And I thought, since this is National Poetry Month, I would read one of my favorite poems by Shel Silverstein, Tug-of-War. I will not play at tug-of-war. I'd rather play at hug-of-war, where everyone hugs instead of tugs, where everyone giggles and rolls on the rug, where everyone kisses and everyone grins and everyone cuddles and everyone wins. So here's a huge hug from me to you, and I'll see you soon.
Hi, my name is Amy Romaine, and I work as the school counselor at Houtling Elementary. Shout out to all of my Houtling Dolphins. Today I'm going to be reading a favorite book of mine titled The Invisible String by Patrice Karst. This story is dedicated to the children of the world and the magic of their strings. Liza and Jeremy, the twins, were asleep one calm and quiet night. Suddenly, it began to rain very hard. Thunder rumbled until it got so loud that it woke them up. "Mommy, Mommy," they cried out as they ran to her. "Don't worry, you two. It's just the storm making all that noise. Go back to bed." "We want to stay close to you," Jeremy said. "We're scared." Mom said, "You know we're always together, no matter what. But how can we be together when you are out here and we're in bed?" said Liza. Mom held something right in front of them and said, "This is how." Rubbing their sleepy eyes, the twins came closer to see what Mom was holding. "I was about your age when my mommy first told me about the invisible string." "I don't see a string," said Jeremy. "You don't need to see the invisible string. People who love each other are always connected by a very special string made of love." "But if you can't see it, how do you know it's there?" asked Liza. "Even though you can't see it with your eyes, you can feel it with your heart and know that you are always connected to everyone you love. When you're at school and you miss me, your love travels all the way along the string until I feel it tug on my heart. And when you tug it right back, we feel it in our hearts. said Jeremy. "Does Jasper, the cat, have an invisible string?" Liza asked. "She sure does," said Mom. "And best friends, like me and Lucy?" asked Liza. "Best friends, too," said Mom. "How far can the string reach?" "Anywhere and everywhere," Mom said. "Would it reach me even if I were a submarine captain deep in the ocean?" asked Jeremy. Mom said, "Even there." "Or a mountain climber?" "Even there." "A ballerina in France?" "Even there." "A jungle explorer?" "Even there." "How about an astronaut out in space?" "Yes, even there." Then Jeremy quietly asked, "Can my string reach all the way to Uncle Brian in heaven?" "Yes, even there." "Does the string go away when you're mad at us?" "Never," said Mom. "Love is stronger than anger, and as long as love is in your heart, the string will always be there. Even when you get older and can't agree about things like what movie to see or who gets to ride in the front seat or what time to go to bed." "Oh, that's right. You two should be in bed." And with that, they all laughed as Mom chased the twins back to their bed. Within a few minutes, they were asleep, even though the storm was still making the same loud noises outside. And as they slept, they started dreaming of all of the invisible strings they have, and all of the strings their friends have, and their friends have, and their friends have, until everyone in the world was connected by invisible strings. And from deep inside, they now could clearly see no one is ever alone. The end. Students, know that even though we can't be at school right now with our friends that we love and miss, along with the adults that we know and love, we are all connected by an invisible string, no matter how far away they are and how long it has been since we've seen them. We are all in this together, and life will eventually return to normal. In the meantime, know that you are loved and missed. Thank you to KRBD for this opportunity to share with our students.
Hello, readers. This is Beth Brandt Erickson, a.k.a. Mrs. B., the Library Media Specialist at Fawn Mountain Elementary School. I am so excited to be here and just cannot thank KRBD enough for this opportunity to keep reading to you. I am able to read this book with permission of Scholastic Publishers, who, like many other publishers and authors, are allowing librarians and teachers to read their material aloud in online settings by waiving copyright and fair use restrictions during these national school closures. Excited to read to you today a section from a favorite book of mine. It's a lovely little mystical, magical book by Cynthia Rylamp. It is called The Van Gogh Cafe. The Van Gogh Cafe. The Cafe. The Van Gogh Cafe sits on Main Street in Flowers, Kansas, and the building it is in was once a theater, which may be the reason for its magic. Anyone who has ever seen anything happen on a stage, anything, knows that a theater is so full of magic that after years and years of opening nights, there must be magic enough to last forever in its walls. The Van Gogh Cafe is lucky it hasn't found itself in a building where people had their broken arms fixed or their teeth pulled out. Those are not the sorts of walls that harbor magic, but theater walls do. Magic is a powerful word and often misused. Some say magic comes from heaven, but anyone who has ever visited the Van Gogh Cafe knows that magic comes from a building that was once a theater. From a sign above a cash register that reads, "Bless all dogs." from a smiling porcelain hen on top of a pie carousel, from purple hydrangeas painted all over a lady's bathroom, from a small brown phonograph that plays "You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To." Magic is in the Van Gogh Cafe in Flowers, Kansas, and sometimes the magic wakes itself up and the people and animal and things start to notice it. They notice it and are affected by it. And pretty soon word spreads that there's a cafe, the Van Gogh Cafe, that is wonderful, like a dream, like a mystery, like a painting, and you ought to go there, they will say, for you will never forget it. You will want to stay if you can. Some have for a while, like the possum. The possum. Kansas is not what one would call picturesque. It is flat. So flat it can make some people a little crazy. People who need a hill now and then to keep their balance. But in Kansas, at least, things get noticed. The flatness makes everything count and not one thing slips by. That is why if a possum was going to choose to hang upside down somewhere, Kansas would be a good choice. People would notice. And if the possum chose to hang outside the window of the Van Gogh Cafe in Flowers, well, then everyone would start talking about magic, and that would be good for the possum, too. The Van Gogh Cafe is owned by a young man named Mark and his daughter, Clara. Clara is the reason for all of the magic in the cafe. She is 10 and believes anything might happen. Mark bought the cafe 7 years ago, and he's the one who painted purple hydrangeas all over the ladies' bathroom and put the sign above the cash register. But the phonograph and the hen were already there, and when he arrived, Clara's mother doesn't like Kansas, and she lives in New York City where Clara visits her each June. But Clara preferred Kansas the moment she laid eyes on it. Kansas is like a tall person relaxing, she says. It seems right for her. Mark and Clara open the cafe at 6 every morning, except Sundays when they sleep until 10. Clara takes breakfast orders from Mark, who is the cook, for half an hour on school mornings, and then she goes to their apartment across the street to get ready for school. Clara likes taking orders because everyone is sleepy and sweet and all they want in the world is a cup of coffee, please. Clara thinks morning is the kindest time of day. Most of the people who come to the Van Gogh Cafe are Flowers people and they know each other. Hi, Ray. Hello, Roy. But sometimes someone is new. For Flowers sits near I-70, which people take when they are escaping from an old life in the East to a new life in the West, or the other way around. Clara has met many people between 6 and 6:30 on their way to somewhere new. But she has not met a possum until today. Today is Saturday, and she's working a couple extra hours for her father, and it is 8 o'clock in the morning when suddenly a possum is hanging upside down in the tree outside the cafe window, right on Main Street. A minute ago it wasn't there, and now it is. Clara sees it first. Look, there's a possum. Coffee cups go down, heads turn, and outside a little gray possum enjoys being noticed. It scratches its nose and blinks its eyes and stares back at all their faces. No one sitting down can say hello to a possum, so everyone in the cafe gets up and stands in front of the window. Now, this is the magic of the Van Gogh Cafe. Not one person says, "Amazing, a possum upside down on Main Street." Nope, everyone is not all that surprised. They, like Clara, have come to believe anything might happen because they have been having breakfast at the Van Gogh Cafe all their lives. What they do say is, "Hi." Many of them wave. Roy asks Ray what possums eat. And with their usual curiosity about every new person in Flowers, they all say, "Wonder where he's from." Well, it's hard to know a possum's story before he does something magical. But after he does, there's a story and more to tell. One of the first stories is that the possum starts coming back to the Van Gogh Cafe every day. 8 in the morning, he's up in the tree. But that's a small story. The possum begins to attract people, and this is the bigger story, because he attracts people who haven't been getting along. Best friends who had a fight the day before, today they're standing on the sidewalk next to the possum. Possum is hanging upside down and blinking, and the two friends are talking, and suddenly they've got their arms around each other and are coming into the cafe for some pie. A young husband and wife the day before were yelling in the front yard. The next day, they're kissing beside the possum. Two neighbors, the day before, they're arguing about loud music. The next day, the possum is watching them shake hands. The story becomes even bigger when people start bringing food out of the Van Gogh Cafe, food for the possum. Half an English muffin here, two pieces of oven-fried potatoes there, a cup of milk. They can't help themselves. They want to give it some food. The possum isn't hungry, but a stray dog from the other end of town is. He starts stopping by for breakfast. So does a thin cat and two baby kittens, and a shy small mouse, several sparrows, even a deer. And this goes on for a while until the biggest story happens. A story that will enter quietly into the walls of the cafe and become part of the magic. For a man whose wife has died drives through Flowers, Kansas, one morning on his way to something new. He is sad, and he isn't really sure where he's going, but passing the Van Gogh Cafe, he sees the possum. He sees the possum, and he sees all the hungry animals standing beneath it, eating the scraps of muffins and potatoes. And the man sees something else there, something, too, that no one has seen until now. And because of what he sees, he turns his car around and drives back to where he belongs, back to his farm, which he turns into a home for stray animals, animals who come to him and take away his loneliness. Since that day, the possum at the Van Gogh Cafe has disappeared. One minute it was there, the next minute it wasn't. But the customers still bring food out of the cafe every morning, leaving scraps beneath the tree in case anyone hungry happens by. There was always a new stray dog, a new thin cat, sparrows. Clara is not surprised the possum has gone away. Things are always changing at the Van Gogh Cafe, and something new is sure to happen, perhaps when lightning strikes. Lightning strikes. After lightning struck the Van Gogh Cafe one day in March, the soup didn't need to be reheated for a week. You could just open a can and the soup would be steaming. Now it is April and the lightning is having an effect. Everything Mark cooks is coming out perfect. Not one burnt crust, not one overcooked egg. Everything has just enough salt the first time. Perfect. The effect of this has not been lost on Mark, who has taken to writing poetry while he cooks. Clara and Mark were both at the cafe when the lightning struck. In fact, they were closing up for the night. Mark had the key in the door, and they were just getting ready to step out into the rain when a blinding light flashed. The cafe popped, and the key in Mark's hand melted inside the lock. But that was the only damage. Odd, but of course, this is the Van Gogh Cafe. Since then, things have been a little tipped. A little tip to one side here at the cafe. The hen's smile is a little crooked. The sign above the register won't stay straight. People come in and their hats fall off. Clara knows it is because of the lightning, and she knows this won't last and everything will straighten up again. But she expects something larger to happen before everyone's hats begin staying on their heads. She expects a bigger story. Naturally, one comes. The smaller story began with the perfect food that Mark was cooking. But this could have just been luck. Perfect food doesn't have to involve magic. However, food that cooks itself does. Mark is thinking of nothing else but poetry. A month ago, he wasn't a poet, and now he is. He's a little crazy with the writing, and since the food he's cooking has been so perfect lately, he's starting to forget about it altogether. He's forgetting to flip the eggs off the grill, to pull the toast from the toaster, to change the coffee grounds. So the food is cooking itself. While Mark is writing his poetry, Eggs are finding the grill, frying and flipping themselves over. Home fries are cooking up to a lovely crispness, and no matter how long they're left on the griddle, they never burn. Biscuits are showing up in pans in the oven, fluffy and hot and brushed with melted butter. Hamburgers are finding buns and lettuce, and French fries are finding oil. Mark is writing fast, writing frantically on anything he can find. Napkins, customer bills, boxes of straws, anything. And being the only person in the kitchen, he hasn't realized that he's not actually cooking all the meals that are appearing on the plates in the Van Gogh Cafe. It is only when the lemon meringue pies start showing up that anyone notices what is happening. Clara notices. She realizes her father is not the one doing the cooking, that lemon meringue pies are beyond him, and she considers saying something about it, but she is so fond of lemon meringue pies, and she is afraid they'll disappear if she tells Mark that he isn't the one baking them. So she waits. She eats a lot of pie, and she waits. Something else is bound to happen eventually, and so it does. So still and blue, waiting, waiting. It is a long silver night. This is the poem Mark writes on a napkin that finds its way to Carla Roker's table. Carla has stopped in for a piece of pie on her way to visit her boyfriend in the next town. She reads the poem on her napkin, looks puzzled, and smiles. She wipes the pie off her face and heads out to her blue truck. It is about 8, just getting dark. And at 11, when Carla has spent nearly 2 hours stranded between flowers in the next town because her blue truck is broken down beside a silver lake, when she sits sitting in the tow truck to come, she remembers the poem on the napkin and the bigger story begins. Mark's poems are telling the future. The back of Judy Jones's bill for grilled cheese and Coke on Monday reads, "Yellow and full. Did you know it would be spring?" And on Tuesday, her neighbor gives her a bouquet of daffodils for her birthday. In the corner of a menu handed to Mary Showers, who has come in for lunch with her mother, a poem reads, "Rain finds a sweetheart in the music." The following day, a boy in the record store asks Mary for a date. And then the real magic happens, the magic that Clara was waiting for. One morning, a young boy comes into the cafe. He is fighting back tears. He asks if anyone has seen his Siamese cat, who's been lost for 3 days. Today is a school holiday, so Clara is working. She hasn't seen the cat, and she feels terrible for the boy. She offers him a piece of lemon meringue pie, free, and tells him she will ask the other customers about the cat while he eats. The boy sits quietly at the table, slowly eating the pie, as Clara goes to every person in the cafe, hoping no one has seen the Siamese. They are all very sorry about it. Clara returns to the boy and sadly shakes her head. He has finished his pie and is about to thank her and go when he glances over at the soup board. Under chicken noodle, he reads, "Blackberries love a moon-faced man so sleepy." The boy stops in his tracks and reads the board over and over, and then he tells Clara the name of his cat, Blackberry. Clara tells the customer sitting at the table, and that customer tells the next, and before long the whole cafe is looking at the soup board. Some of them have already read their futures on napkins or menus. They know what they're seeing. Van Gogh Cafe is silent. All eyes on the board, and everyone is thinking, where is a moon-faced man in Flowers, Kansas? Then someone whispers, "The motel." Yes, there's only one motel in Flowers. It's not a very good one, but it does have a lovely name that has fooled a lot of tourists who reserved their rooms sight unseen. It is called the Moonlight Manor. And it is a sign, and its sign beside the highway shows a round, sleepy moon, eyes closed, mouth smiling, little hearts flying all around. The motel is a good 3 miles from the cafe, so everyone's So someone gives the boy a ride. And in the ivy planter beneath the Motel Manor sign, Blackberry is sleeping. Her leg had been hurt, but she's all right. The boy cries and cries. He's so happy. The next day at the Van Gogh Cafe, everyone is buzzing. They know for sure now that Mark's poems are omens, fortunes, signs. What will his next one say? But the speculation about omens doesn't last long. It has been replaced by complaints. Frank Mill has been waiting 20 minutes for his eggs. When they finally arrive, they're runny. Kathleen Cooper's pancakes are cold. Winston Fuller's steak is as tough as leather, and there's not one lemon meringue pie in sight. Food has stopped cooking itself. Mark has stopped writing poetry, and everyone's hat is staying on his head. Things are back to normal. Clara is naturally a little disappointed, especially about the pies. It's back to plain old apple pies now. She won't be disappointed long. Lemon meringue pies can be lovely, but they're nothing compared to magic muffins. Thank you so much for listening to this part of the Van Gogh Cafe, and hopefully I'll be able to finish up this book with you a little bit later. Thanks.
Sipagong at Simaching, The Turtle and the Monkey, written by Dr. Jose Rizal. Minsan ay may dalawang magkaibigan, sila ay Sipagong the Turtle at Simaching the Monkey. Sipagong ay mabait at matulungin, at Simaching naman ay tuso at palabiro. Pagong and Maching were best friends. If Pagong was kind and helpful friend, Maching was a sly. He liked to make fun of Pagong. One day, they were walking by the river. Naglakad sila sa may ilog when Maching saw a floating banana tree. Nakakita sila na may lumulutaw na puno ng saging. Pagong, look! A banana tree! Let's go get it! They decided to cut the banana tree into two. Pinutol nila ito sa dalawa para paghatiin. Since Maching saw the banana tree first, he insisted that he will take home the trunk that already has some leaves, thinking that it will soon bear fruit. Akin ang itaas ng bahagi, Pagong, at dali-dali kinuha ni Maching ang itaas na parte ng puno. Walang nagawa si Pagong kundi inuwi niya ang ilalim ng parte kung saan may mga ugat. So Pagong was given the part with the roots. They went home, planted the banana tree that they own, at inalagaan nila ito. Days went by, Pagong's plant slowly grew leaves, and it grew bigger until it bore fruit, while Maching's plant died. The leaves withered, and the trunk decayed. Maching came to Pagong, so pumunta si Maching kay Pagong.
My plant died, Pagong.
Sagot naman ni Pagong. Don't be sad, Maching. Huwag ka malungkot. I will share my harvest with you.
Okay, let me climb the tree for you then, said Maching.
So inakyat ni Maching ang puno ng banana. Once Maching reached the top of the tree, he greedily ate all of the bananas.
Hey, Maching, give me some. Bigyan mo ako, Maching, said Pagong.
At ang sagot ni Maching,
no, these are not even enough for me. Kulang nga ito sa akin.
Patuloy ni Maching inubos ang mga saging. Pagong was so angry. Galit na galit si Pagong. He began to stick many thorns on the tree trunk. Kumuha si Pagong ng mga tinik at itinusok sa puno ng saging. Naisip nitong bigyan ng leksyon ang kasakiman ni Maching. After Maching felt full, nang mabusog na si Maching, he went down the tree. Nang bumaba siya, he screamed in pain.
Ouch! Ouch! Pagong! You will pay for this! Magbayad ka sa ginawa mo, Pagong!
On the ground, Pagong hid under the coconut shell. Nagtago si Pagong sa isang balat ng nyog. Ang hindi niya alam, upo dun si Matsing para tanggalin ang mga tinik sa kanyang paa. As Matsing sat on the coconut shell to remove the thorns, bigla kinagat ni Pagong ang buntot ni Matsing. Pagong bit Matsing's tail and quickly hid under the coconut shell again, so nagtago uli si Pagong sa balat ng nyog. In a rage, Matsing lifted the coconut shell. Ang galit na si Matsing, itinaas ang balat ng nyog. Wala ka ng takas, Pagong. You can't run away from me, Pagong. You will pay for what you have done. I will cook you now. When you cook me, I will turn red. And I'd be more attractive, Matsing. Ha! What about if I just throw you in the river and let you drown there? Itatapon kita sa ilog at hayaang malunod dun. So Pagong pretended to be scared. Nagpanggap si Pagong na takot. Matsing, please, no, not the river. So Matsing threw Pagong into the river with vengeance. So galit na itinapon ni Matsing si Pagong sa ilog. Once Pagong reached into the water, he laughed. Tumawa si Pagong. Matsing, you're not thinking. Did you not know I live in water? Hindi mo ba alam, Matsing, na ang ilog ay aking bahay? Matsing scratched his head in confusion. Napakamot na lang si Matsing sa kanyang ulo. He went home and regretted his actions. Pinagsisihan ni Matsing ang kanyang ugali. Matsing had changed after then, but he never saw Pagong again. He realized he didn't just lost a friend, but a good friend. Lesson of the story. We should always appreciate people's kindness. What we do will always come back to us. May kasabihan tayo sa Pilipino, matalino man ang matching, ay maiisahan din.
Welcome, listeners. We're going to begin The World According to Humphrey, a magnificent novel by Betty G. Burney. One of the magical elements of authoring a book is being able to write from any character's viewpoint you choose. And also, one of the magical experiences in life is a great school year. The seasons, the learning, the life lessons, celebrations, and growth, they're the moments we remember. In The World According to Humphrey, our author shares both a story from a unique viewpoint and a great school year. Early on, you listeners will be able to tell whose viewpoint the story is coming from, and you'll be surprised at who is telling the story and how much we can learn from him. Chapter 1, The Return of Mrs. Brisbane. Today was the worst day of my life. Miss Mack left room 26 of Longfellow School for good, and that's bad. Worse yet, Mrs. Brisbane came back. Until today, I didn't even know there was a Mrs. Brisbane. Lucky me. Now I want to know, what was Miss Mack thinking? She must have known that soon she'd be leaving without me, and that Mrs. Brisbane would come back to room 26, and I'd be stuck with her. I still like... Okay, love Miss Mack more than any human or hamster on earth. But what was she thinking? You can learn a lot about yourself by taking care of another species, she told me on the way home the day she got me. You'll teach those kids a thing or two. That is what she was thinking. I don't think she was thinking very clearly. I'm never going to squeak to her again. Of course, I'll probably never see her again, because she's gone, gone, gone. But if she comes back, I'm not even going to look at her. I know that last sentence doesn't make sense. It's hard to make sense when your heart is broken. On the other hand, until Miss Mack arrived, I was going nowhere down at Petorama. My days were spent sitting around, looking at a bunch of furry things in cages just like mine. We were treated all right, regular meals, clean cages, music piped in all day. Over the music, Carl, the store clerk, would answer the phone. open 9 to 9, 7 days a week, corner of 5th and Alder, next to the Dairy Maid. Back then, I feared I'd never see 5th and Alder, much less the Dairy Maid. Sometimes I'd see human eyes and noses, not always as clean as they should be, poking up against the glass. Nothing ever came of it. The children were excited to see me, but the parents usually had other ideas.
Oh, come see the fishes, Cornelia. So colorful and so much easier to take care of than a hamster,
Mama might say. Or, no, no, Norbert, they have the cutest little puppies over here. After all, a dog is a boy's best friend. So there we were. Hamsters, gerbils, mice, and guinea pigs. Not nearly as popular as the fish, cats, or dogs. I suspected that I'd be spinning my wheel at Petorama forever. But once Miss Mac carried me out the door a short 6 weeks ago, my life changed fast, fast, fast. I saw 5th. I saw Alder. I saw the Dairy Maid with the statue of a cow in an apron outside. I was dozing when she first came to Petorama, as I do during the day, because hamsters are more active at night.
Oh, hello.
A warm voice awakened me. When I opened my eyes, I saw a mass of bouncy black curls, a big happy smile, huge dark eyes. She smelled of apples. It was love at first sight.
Oh, aren't you the bright-eyed one?
She asked.
And might I return the compliment?
I replied. Of course, it came out,
squeak, squeak, squeak,
as usual. Miss Mac opened up her purse with the big pink and blue flowers on it.
I'll take him, she told Carl. He's obviously the most intelligent and handsome hamster you have.
Carl grunted. Then Miss Mac picked out a respectable cage.
Okay, not the 3-story pagoda I'd had my eye on, but a nice cage.
And soon, amid squeals of encouragement from my friends in the small pet department, from the teeniest white mouse to the lumbering chinchilla, I left Petorama with high hopes. We sped down the street in Miss Mac's bright yellow car. She called it a bug, but I could see it was really a car. She carried my cage up the stairs to her apartment. We ate apples. We watched TV. She let me run around outside my cage. She gave me my very own name, Humphrey, and she told me all about Room 26, where we'd be going the next morning.
And since you're an intelligent hamster who is going to school, I have a present for you, Humphrey,
she said. Then she gave me a tiny little notebook and a tiny little pencil.
I got these for you at the doll shop, she explained.
She tucked them behind my mirror where no one could see them except me. Of course, it might be a while before you learn to read and write, she continued, but you are smart, and I know you'll catch on fast. Little did she know, I could already make out some words from my long, boring days at Petorama. Words like chew toys, kibble, pooper scoopers. Remember, a hamster is grown up at about 5 weeks old, so if I could learn all the skills I need for life in 5 weeks, how long could it possibly take to learn to read? Well, I'll tell you. A week. Yep, in a week, I could read and even write a little with a tiny pencil. In addition to schoolwork, I learned quite a bit about the other students in Room 26, like, lower your voice, AJ, and speak up, Saya, and wait for the bell, Garth, and Golden Miranda. Even after I found out her name is really Miranda Golden, I thought of her as Golden Miranda because of her long blonde hair. After all, I am a golden hamster. Yes, life in Room 26 suited me well during the day. My cage had all the comforts a hamster could ask for. I had bars on the windows to protect me from my enemies. I had a little sleeping house in one corner where no one could see me or bother me. There was my wheel to spin on, of course, and a lovely pile of nesting material. My mirror came in handy to check my grooming and to hide my notebook. In one corner, I kept my food. The opposite corner was my bathroom area because hamsters like to keep their poo away from their food. Who doesn't? All my needs were taken care of in one convenient cage. At night, I went home from school with Miss Mac, and we watched TV or listened to music. Sometimes Miss Mac played her bongo drums. She made a tunnel on the floor so I could race and wiggle to my hamster heart's content. Oh, the memories of those 6 weeks with Morgan McNamara. That's her real name, but she told her students to call her Miss Mac. That's how nice she is, or was. On the weekends, Miss Mac and I had all kinds of adventures. She put me in her shirt pocket right over her heart and took me with her to the laundry room. She had friends over, and they laughed and made a fuss over me. She even took me for a bike ride once. I can still feel the wind in my fur. I didn't have an inkling until this morning of the unspeakable thing she was about to do to me. On the way to work, she said, "Humphrey, I hate to tell you, but this is my last day in room 26, and I'm going to miss you more than you'll ever know." What was she saying? I hung onto my wheel for dear life. You see, it's really Mrs. Brisbane's class. But just before school started, her husband was in an accident, so I took over the class. Today she's coming back for good. Good? I could see nothing good in what Miss Mac was saying. Besides, I want to see the world, Humphrey, she told me. Fine with me. I've thoroughly enjoyed all the world I've seen so far, and would go to the ends of the earth with Miss Mac. But she wasn't finished yet. But I can't take you with me. All hopes dashed, completely. Besides, the kids need you to teach them responsibility. Mrs. Brisbane needs you too. Unfortunately, she didn't tell Mrs. Brisbane that. Mrs. Brisbane was already in room 26 when we arrived. She smiled at Miss Mac and shook her hand. Then she frowned at me and said, "Is that some kind of rodent?" Miss Mac gave her the speech about how much kids can learn from taking care of another species. Mrs. Brisbane looked horrified and said, I can't stand rodents. Take it back. The it she was talking about was me. Miss Mac didn't bat an eyelash. She put my cage in its usual place next to the window and said the kids were already very attached to me. She attached Dr. Harvey H. Hammer's Guide to the Care and Feeding of Hamsters to the cage, along with a chart to make sure I was fed and my cage was cleaned on time. The children know what to do. You don't have to do a thing, Miss Mac said as Mrs. Brisbane glared at me. Just then, my fellow students came streaming into the room, and within half an hour, Miss Mac had said goodbye to everyone, including me. I'll never forget you, Humphrey, she whispered. Don't you forget me either.
Not likely, but I don't know if I can ever forgive you, I squeaked.
And then she was gone, without me. Mrs. Brisbane didn't even come close to my cage until recess. Then she walked over and said, Mister, you've got to go. But she doesn't know my secret. The latch on my cage door doesn't work. It never has. It's the lock that doesn't lock. So I've got news for Mrs. Brisbane. If I've got to go, it will be when and where I decide to go, not her. Meanwhile, I'm not turning my back on this woman, not for a second. If I ever disappear and someone finds this notebook, just check out Mrs. Brisbane, please. And that's the end of chapter one, and each chapter ends with a tip from the Guide to the Care and Feeding of Hamsters by Dr. Harvey H. Hammer. Tip one, choose your new hamster's home very carefully. And make sure it is secure. Hamsters are skillful escape artists, and once out of their cages, they are very difficult to find. Chapter 2, Nightlife. For the rest of the day, I felt sad, sad, sad.
Oh, you look sad, Humphrey,
Golden Miranda said when she was cleaning my cage right before lunch. According to the chart Miss Mac had left, it was her turn to take care of me. Thank goodness. Miranda was the best cage cleaner and never said, yuck. She put on throwaway gloves, then cleaned my potty corner, changed my bedding, gave me fresh water, and finally, oh joy, gave me fresh grain, some lettuce, and mealworms.
This will make you happy, she said as she
slipped me the special treat she'd brought from home, cauliflower. Naturally, Miranda had good taste. I promptly saved it in my cheek pouch, until I could store it in my sleeping house. Hamsters like to stash food for the future. After my cage was taken care of, I felt well enough to observe Mrs. Brisbane more carefully. Now Miss Mac was tall, wore bright blouses, short skirts, and high shoes. She wore bracelets that jingled, jangled. She spoke in a loud voice and waved her arms and walked all around the room when she talked. Mrs. Brisbane, on the other hand, was short, with short gray hair. She wore dark clothes and flat shoes, and she didn't jingle jangle at all. She spoke in a voice just loud enough to hear and sat at her desk or stood at the chalkboard when she taught. No wonder I was feeling drowsy after lunch. All that nice food, all that soft talking. "Is that all this hamster does, sleep?" she asked at one point when she glanced over at my cage.
"Well, he's turtle," replied Raise Your Hand Heidi Hopper.
"Raise your hand, Heidi," said Mrs. Brisbane. "What is turtle?"
"You know, turtle. He sleeps during the day," said Heidi.
I was awake now.
"Nocturnal,"
I squeaked.
"Hamsters are nocturnal."
"Oh, you mean nocturnal," said Mrs. Brisbane, almost as if she had understood me. She turned and wrote the word on the board. "Can anyone else name an animal that is nocturnal?"
"Owl,"
said Heidi. "Raise your hand, Heidi," said Mrs. Brisbane. "But that is correct. An owl is nocturnal. Anyone else?" A voice shouted out.
"My dad."
Mrs. Brisbane looked around.
"Who said that?"
"He did, AJ." Garth Tugwell pointed at AJ. Both boys sat at the table nearest to my cage.
"What about your dad?"
Mrs. Brisbane asked. AJ squirmed in his seat.
"Well, my mom always says my dad is nocturnal because he stays up so late watching TV.
Stop giggling, Gail, and a few other students snickered. Mrs. Brisbane didn't crack a smile.
"Her use of the word is correct," she said, "though technically humans are not nocturnal. Any others?"
Eventually, the class came up with more names of nocturnal animals, like bats and coyotes and opossums, and Mrs. Brisbane said that the class would be learning more about animal habits later in the year. If she'd just look at me, she could learn a lot. But I noticed for the rest of the day that Mrs. Brisbane stayed far away from my cage, as if I had a disease or something. She read a mighty fine story to us in the afternoon, though. In fact, I couldn't get back to my nap afterward. It was about a scary house and these scratching noises and a ghost. Thump, thump, thump. The ghost came down the hall. Oh, I had shivers and quivers. I have to say, Mrs. Brisbane knows how to read a story. Her voice changed and her eyes got wide, and I forgot about her gray hair and her dark suit. To squeak the truth, my fur was on end. The story had a funny ending because it turned out the ghost wasn't a ghost at all. It was an owl. At the end of the story, everybody laughed, even Mrs. Brisbane. I was beginning to think that life with this new teacher wouldn't be so bad. But I changed my mind when the bell rang at the end of the day and all my classmates raced out of the room, leaving me alone with her. She erased the chalkboard and gathered up her papers. I could tell that we'd be going home soon. Suddenly, I began to worry. What if Mrs. Brisbane lived in a scary house with spooky noises and a thumping ghost? Or even worse, what if Mrs. Brisbane had a scary pet like a dog? My mind was racing as fast as I was spinning my wheel when she finally approached and looked down at me, frowning.
"Well, you're on your own now," she said.
With that, she closed the blinds and walked away. But I heard her muttering,
"Rodent, are you kidding me?"
under her breath. She left the classroom and closed the door. She left me alone, all alone, in room 26. I had never, ever been alone before. As the room slowly grew darker and quieter, I thought back to the happy times at Miss Mack's apartment. There were always cheery lights on and music and telephone talking and, oh dear, during the day I never noticed how the clock on the wall ticked off the seconds one by one very loudly. Tick, tick, tick. I was feeling sick, sick, sick. I wondered if there were any owls around room 26 or ghosts. I tried to pass the time by writing in my notebook about Petorama and my days at Miss Mack's apartment. Writing took my mind off my jittery nerves, but eventually my writing paw began to ache and I had to stop my scratchings. If only I could roam free as I had at Miss Mack's apartment. Then I remembered the lock that doesn't lock. The took only a few seconds to jiggle the door open. I skittered across the table. Then, grasping the top of the table leg tightly, I closed my eyes and slid to the ground. Ah, freedom. I dashed along the shiny floor. I darted between the tables and chairs. I stopped to nibble a peanut underneath Stop Giggling Gail's chair. It tasted delicious and made the coolest crunching sound. I chewed and chomped and gnawed and nibbled, and when I stopped, I heard the sound. Thump, thump, thump. Just like the story Mrs. Brisbane had read us. Thump, thump, thump. Closer and closer down the hall, coming toward room 26. Then rattle, scratch, rattle, scratch. Thump, thump, thump. Suddenly, I longed for the protective comfort of my cage. I dropped what was left of the peanut and scampered back. But when I got to the table, I thought a terrible thought. I had slid down the smooth, shiny leg straight down. But how was I going to climb up again? I flung myself against the table leg, grabbed on and pushed up, up, up. But I had only made a little progress. When I began to slide down, 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 I was right back where I'd started. The rattling got louder. The sounds weren't coming toward room 26 anymore. They were coming in room 26. In room 26. Room 26.
Old Friends by Ted Kuzier, U.S. Poet Laureate. Old friends are a steady spring rain, or late summer sunshine edging into fall, or frosted leaves along a snowy path. A voice for all seasons saying, I know you. The older I grow, the more I fear I'll lose my old friends, as if too many years have scrolled by since the day we sprang forth seeking each other. Old friend, I knew you before we met. I saw you at the window of my soul. I heard you in the steady millstone of my heart, grinding grain for our daily bread. You are sedimentary, rock-solid cousin earth, where I stand firmly, astonished by your grace and truth. And gratitude comes to me and says, tell me anything, and I will listen. Ask me anything, and I will answer you.
Thank you to local teachers for taking the time to send us recordings for this special program. You're listening to KRBD Ketchikan.